Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
QNL.
With guest co-hosts...
Narsberry. We're going to put our first-time guest on the spot, not that we've ever done that before. And was there something... Phil approves.
It's on the news.
Welcome to episode 146. I'm Dan Q. This is your brain on podcasting, joined by Makalua.
He's more caffeine, definitely, yes.
The Mean Team.
Terrorizing children since forever.
And our guest, Danny, also known as Snarsberry.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Sib 001. That's what he is. He wants to know what you think cities in your game look like. Posted in there, so in the current Civ game you're playing, what do you think your city's looking like now? Describe it to me.
Oh, I can do that in one word. Shiny.
Is it the nuclear era yet? Because there's a big difference in my answer.
No, that's glowy. I'm not quite to the glowy, just the shiny, just the shiny. And I had to say that, by the way, that was in my contract.
It's better than my opponent's cities. I'd take glowy over smoldering piles of ash.
I was about to say, his opponent's cities are craters.
In my cities, I just see statues of me everywhere.
Yeah, that's what somebody's like. Somebody's response in here was something to that.
And a Senate that votes me like dictator every year.
So you're only slightly narcissistic, is what you're saying?
Only slightly.
Okay. I actually like a couple of responses in this thread that were a bit more descriptive and put a bit more effort into their responses. Good for them. Old Scald, Marbo, Gold, Neoclassical Columns, Palatial Glass-Domed Railway Termini, Georgian-Style Military Barracks, Steel and Tinted Glass Corporate Headquarters. It's all rather nice, really. Except Paris, which is currently occupied by my forces, having just been captured, and is largely a smoking ruin.
There we go.
Contrasts. The award goes to Sheng Wulin. It's generally a pretty nice place until the late Renaissance, at which point angry men run through the streets with whips, forcing the poor citizens to clamber onto horses, grab muskets, and charge en masse at neighboring empires, where thousands of them will perish on the walls of the enemy castles. Good times.
Depends on your definition of good times.
The draft is always good times.
Oh, the draft, not feeling a draft. Okay, yeah. All right, okay. I'm with you now.
That too, but that's not what I was going for. I think there's just every city in the game needs to have a giant bust of my face, in the center of the city. Other than that, I don't have to be too controlling of the cities. They just need that in the city center.
I'm sorry, all I heard was bust.
Damn, come on. I was going to just say for Phil, we could just change the city tile to the troll face.
Every city.
Troll face. Well, I guess I found Phil's territory. Frisbee over in the Sifanatics forums wanted to know about the best defensive promotion for a galley. And I'm like, wait, what? You use those for defense? You use enough galleys to worry about this? That may be just me and I don't play enough Navy. He says, like everyone, I hate bark galleys and do my best to spawn bust, but when the AI leads a galley into my territory, you gotta throw down. So he usually takes the drill one promotion, but he thought he'd ask the experts, assuming you only play defensively, is that the best way to go?
Well, basically, you're not going to be seeing a lot of fights with galleys, hopefully, because the answer to getting rid of the galleys, barbed galleys anyway, in pretty much any Civ 4 game is warriors and orcs and spawn busting, which, like he said, he tries to do. But if they are going to enter your lane, and you're not quite the triremes yet for whatever reason that can often happen in the late PCs, okay. Well, combat will give you better odds, and drill won't. It's as simple as that. You have better odds fighting with combat one than you have with drill, and you will every time against the barb galley. So there's really no reason to go down anything but the combat line. Now, if you're talking about other promotions for a galley, then you can actually get a bit more interesting. You know, maybe go for navigation or something. But when it comes to barb defense, you want combat. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, combat one is going to give you a plus 10% strength, and the drill one, it's a plus one first strike chance. And I think that chance word is also key, combined with the fact that what you can get with a combat one. So at plus 10%, if you have a galley, it's strength 2. So you get plus 10%. Okay, so now it's at 2.2 strength. But then you also have plus 10% from coastal defense, which is, of course, where your galleys are going to be because they can't enter the ocean. So there's another plus 10%. So now you're at 2.4. ZX0ZX in the thread, build a trireme. If you're not quite there yet and you have galley difficulties, and most likely it is going to be barb galley difficulties, and yes, I know there is also up to, not including monarch, but any difficulty level before that, you also have the bonus against barbarians, right, as the human player, which of course would apply to both.
Yeah, but on the difficulties where galleys tend to be their worst, yeah, those bonuses aren't there anymore. And it does get annoying, too, because it's also what causes them to enter the borders early enough that you can't have Trifirenes ready. So, you know, if you're playing on an Emperor Plus, there's a good chance that they're going to start entering the borders, so, you know, somewhere between 1000 DC and 1 AD. And metal casting is rarely a priority in that time frame. It's not even a reasonable tech to get in that time frame. It'll often set you back so hugely that it's stupid. So you kind of have to game the mechanics a little bit to get around it.
And this threat title is best defensive promotion for a galley, so you may be thinking, well, no, wait a minute, doesn't combat more about going on the offense? Well, first off, yes, a good defense can be a good offense, but of course, combat one would apply whether you are going on the offense or the defense. And again, drill one, +1 first strike chance. If it was +1 first strike period, that there wasn't necessarily a chance that it would be a given, it might make the discussion a bit more interesting on the defensive side. But with that chance word in there, there really is no reasonable debate.
Drill would still lose. Drill 2 would lose to combat 1 in this scenario. Because the first strikes, they don't raise your absolute odds that much. First strikes are more important when you're either very far ahead in terms of strength or very far behind, so you can do some damage. They're not really that great when the units are close to each other in strength. Because basically, it just gives you an extra round of combat where if you lose, it doesn't count. That's not as good as having a better chance of winning every round of combat when each person needs 5 hits to take the combat. It just doesn't do enough for your odds. If you're, like, defending a city, and you have city garrison 3, and you're on a hill, and they don't have something that ignores first strikes, okay, fine, there's a good chance you'll kill them without taking damage then. And then you can kill lots of units without taking damage. That's what first strikes you for minimizing your damage when you're way ahead of somebody in terms of strength, but it makes no sense in galley versus galley at all. This is the to-do list started by Sissatil. This is a bit of a long post, but basically he's still playing Civ regularly. Bring back the All-Eater Challenge. Do it, Sissatil, you know you want it. And he has basics covered, but he often kicks himself for forgetting or delaying a task or tactic that is important not to overlook. So, he has the list, and he's saying, feel free to add to it. First one is Statue of Zeus, and he wants to know who has it and where it is before he launches war, so that he doesn't get surprised by war weariness. Then there's Heroic Epic City, he wants to make sure he builds it. He doesn't usually forget it, because he's the one on here. But you also have to get the experience for it, and sometimes it's not always easy. Ironwork City, same deal, but not with experience, and then Forbidden Palace. And you can add anything you want, really, to this to-do list. I don't know, guys. Let's hear what you have first. I'm curious what others put on their to-do list.
Build a granary in your cities as soon as possible.
Yes, that's true. It's definitely on the to-do list. It's more at the tactical level than strategic, because you're only concentrating on one city at a time rather than empires as a whole. But that's definitely the best build in most cities, and I don't know if I can say it in enough episodes repeatedly. Like, maybe we should say it in every episode we can, because people still mess up on the building the granary ASAP. It's easily your best building option, unless you're not going to grow, or you have, like, 3 food resources early game, and you're trying to build settlers or something. Other than that, granary is excellent. I think one of the to-do lists is to get to 6 cities, and to plan so that you can if you don't have them already. Especially on high levels, you need that for the National Wonders. There's something you have to, well, not all of them, but some of the National Wonders. It's something you really need to plan for. And if you can't get it, then and that really cuts down on your options. And then now you can't get Oxford, you can't get Globe Theater, and you can't get pretty much anything that requires 6 buildings course, if you have six cities, then all of a sudden you can get your super capital and put a couple of your best national leaders there, maybe put national epic somewhere else, and your empire is a lot stronger. So I mean, sometimes on D80 you can't do it, fine, whatever, but that's one of those dubious things where you want to get your six cities as quickly as possible, well, as quickly as reasonable, and block to get more cities if your economy is hurting.
I think that's one of the things that Suit 4 does really well, is just that that feeling at the beginning of the game when you have that long-term planning, when you're thinking, you know, production city, great person farm, heroic epic city. It's you can really look at a map for a long time and kind of plan. You can plan a little bit too much sometimes. And it's something that Suit 5 doesn't do quite as well as Suit 4. You know, the combinations of national wonders and stuff you can get in the cities is really, there are many ways you can go about that.
Here's a very, very good one for Voices of Unreason. I usually remember this. Sometimes I forget, but man, I see people forget this all the time. Remember to train the two-weaver to explore neighbor's lands with open borders or sign. That means a scout, a spare chariot, whatever you need. Build one of those guys and move it through their land and seal. Know pretty much everything on your continent, unless you're Tokugawa on your continent or human players. Yeah, long before it becomes available. And not only that, you can station the two mover when you're done in border cities near you to see the AI is messing. And that's probably just as good as looking at if they're plotting war for the most part. So that's a big advantage. And it's not very costly. You build one unit, maybe two units, and you get everything explored. Why don't you put too much maintenance on that? Very good thing to do.
To that end, if you are playing Beyond the Sword, the second expansion pack for Civ 4, focus your espionage. If you have contact with more than one AI, and if you're thinking of targeting one, or you're concerned about that you are going to be the target of one nearby, then focus your espionage on that person. Even if you never actively use it, if you're just trying to build up the espionage points so that you can... Demographic doesn't take very long to get that and maintain that, but to find out what they're researching, maybe even gain visibility into some of their cities, and just do what you can to also prevent them, although it's often more annoying than anything, from them taking espionage actions against you, just to give you that little bit of edge in terms of further, air quote, exploration.
You seem to be a little bit distressed by espionage. I can't imagine why that would be weird. You steal like four tanks off of them or anything.
No, I'm sure it's completely random. That would never happen in a cooperative game with human players. No, not at all.
Yeah, no, not at all. Well, I don't see how that's not co-op anyway. It's silliness. Mecha anti-Kithera right here is just revolt to anything after building pyramids. This is a good idea. I think we've all made that mistake once if we played for any significant time, building pyramids and then forgetting to revolt into a different set. Very nice.
As you are expanding either peacefully or more likely through conquest, be mindful of your economy. From that end, thinking about, okay, I want to be able to get to currency, or before that, if you have a lot of coastal cities, you want to be able to make certain that you know, pick up sailing so that you can work the coast. And, oh yeah, you want to be able to have pottery so you can have some cottages to help to be able to support your economy, because there's nothing like going... Oh, expansion, things are going well, I'm on the offensive, or it's peaceful, and wait, what's this? Units on strike, units being disbanded, what? What happened?
That makes a good point, and I can give some concrete numbers here, because you do get some variance based on difficulty with how many cities you can get away with. Now, this is stolen from Victor Wu, but he's posted it multiple times on Systematic Strategy. You really want to get to writing before your research per turn, not your percentage or whatever, but your absolute beaker value per turn drops below 8. Because otherwise it takes too long. Now, if you have writing, you can build or with libraries and scientists, and that can take you pretty far between the great scientists and the straight research that they provide. You can get to, you know, Alphabet to build research, you can get to a different technology and trade for Alphabet if trades are on, and obviously it opens up bulbs that you can use, or an academy which will further improve your research rate. It's a really huge boon, and you really want to get started at least in one city, or running scientists as soon as possible. And that's going to be a big one on my to-do list, because I often neglect that and want to expand more. But if you want a fast start, that's the way to go, and something that you should always have. That's definitely on everyone's to-do list, whether they like it or not, is to get that library with two scientists very early.
All right, is that it for the to-do list for Civ 4? I mean, it's very generalized advice, of course, so...
Yeah, and you can put anything you want on there, depending on who you are personally and what you feel you need to work on. So it's not like something we can concretely iron out and say, okay, this is your to-do list. You have to do this if you want to play well. And that's not how it goes, really. Unless you want us to be here for hours. So, might be amusing, but you know, we have physical limitations, so I think it's better we continue to the next topic. But it's not a bad thing to keep in mind.
Let's give a preview of the not-to-do list. Stop listening to Polycast. There you go. That's don't do that. That's bad.
There you go.
Penalty box.
This isn't a hockey game, Dan. You and your Canadianisms.
Fine. Time out.
Better.
By King Oosterveld, and it's a question on about whether or not there would be a pre-release demo, a downloadable content for sort of bug testing and just to put it out there for the players to play it before the actual release. People are saying either yes or no. I think it's, you know, I think it's highly unlikely that that's going to happen. But I would love to get my hands on it, don't get me wrong, just to satisfy my own curiosity.
If you look at the history of the Civ series, that's just not done.
They do demos for the main game, but I've never done an expansion demo that I remember.
That's the other dynamic here. Yes, we're talking about a demo for an expansion. If you want, I know it's not the same because the expansion is going to reintroduce religion and espionage, but there is a Civilization V demo, which came out a few days after the game came out. It's the sixth most popular demo on Steam. Yes, it's still on the top 10 list. I must admit, I was kind of surprised. And you can have it and play the first 100 turns of a game, all for a mere 2.6 gigabyte download.
A mere 2.6. You know, for people who are not super fast internet, that's not a small download. Not me. That would be fine with me, but...
Yeah, I'd love to get my hands on Gods and Kings for 100 turns of play, but I don't think it's going to happen.
No, and it's always nice to actually have the demo come out after the game has been released, because A, you know you are getting, or more likely to get anyway, a more finished product that the demo is actually reflecting what final gameplay is. And if you really like the demo, then you can turn around and buy the game right away.
Personally, I think demos would come out on the same day as the game every time, regardless if we're talking Civ or anything else. Just put the demo out on the day of the game.
And I know if you're doing a staggered release by region, like that's happening with the Gods and King expansion for a few days, okay, if you want that reflected in the demo availability too, sure, but on the same day that the game is available for the region or worldwide or whatever, then have the demo at the same time. I'm not sure what an advantage would be to actually not doing that, and that could actually be a disadvantage, because what if then there is a, you know, like a day zero patch or a patch relatively soon after release, and then there's the demo, and the demo probably doesn't reflect that. Of course, any discussion about demo makes me think of the days, actually before high-speed internet, and you would really like to... I know that I would like to get a gaming magazine that came with a CD that had demos on it before I decided whether or not I actually wanted to go and purchase the game in a brick-and-mortar store.
Man.
Wow, you're that old.
I am that old,
I
yes.
I still buy some games in, quote-unquote, brick-and-mortar, and that's what GameStop has some of that, and you have to trade in your old games, and that's often more convenient than... going and waiting.
I walk in them from time to time, but that's about it.
Now that we've mentioned GameStop on the show, now I have to invoice them for the mention. Ah, oh, jeez. Okay, I'll do that as soon as the show's done. I'll write myself a note.
And here I thought invoicing others would be desirable. It's much better than being invoiced.
We discussed the expansion at length, in particular, religion, and to some extent, espionage, as well as the effects on the existing mechanics within Civilization V. Well, anticipated anyway, because the information that we are getting is, of course, from... I'm not even sure actually any of those previews are actually gameplay previews, but just observations of other people playing the game and interviews and whatnot. But one thing we really haven't mentioned, other than in passing, are the scenarios that Gods and Kings are going to include. And there is some reason, there is an actual fair reason why we really didn't focus on any of the scenarios in Gods and Kings, is because there really isn't known much about them, other than their name, and then maybe a phrase, or at most a sentence, about what it is that is to be included. So, And the lack of information, of course, does not mean that people don't form opinions on what they're anticipating, and the title is really getting, I would say, most of the attention, the titles, along with the descriptions. This thread started by JFD with a poll. Of course, the three scenarios are the fall of Rome, Into the Renaissance, and the Empire of the Smoky Skies. And right now, Into the Renaissance has the most votes at 40, followed by the Empire of the Smoky Skies at 22, and the fall of Rome at 18. And we'll talk about the rest of the poll in a moment. But JFD is personally looking forward to Into the Renaissance 1 and the Empire of the Smoky Skies. Into the Renaissance is to focus on religion in the Middle Ages into the Renaissance era. Empire of the Smoky Skies is, when you look at the history of the Civilization series, this is new, a Victorian-era steampunk scenario. So this is your science fiction entry, science fiction-ish entry. And then, of course, the fall of Rome is about the decline of the Roman Empire. Now, Civilization IV Warlords included the rise of Rome, and so now, with the Civilization V expansion, Gods and Kings, you can look at the fall of Rome, because, you know, what goes up must come down, and what rises must fall. Civilization III Conquest, the second expansion for Civ III, included both a rise of Rome and the fall of Rome scenario, along with seven others.
This sounds very familiar from
the And no doubt, if you were a fan of one or both of those scenarios, you'd probably be interested to check out this one, because it may be similar, but of course, just based on game mechanics alone, we know that it won't be the same. But I thought it was also interesting just to go back through all existing Civ titles and see, in terms of scenario popularity, and by scenario popularity, I'm of course referring to those scenarios that are included in the game itself, not actual numbers of scenarios that are available to acquire online. Civilization V can get scenarios. You can get 8 of them, although for 7 of them you're going to have to pay because it's through downloadable content. Now, the Free Mongolian Civ included a free scenario, so there's your one free one. And then Gods of Kings includes 3, so that's 11. In Civilization IV, between Warlords and Beyond the Sword, there were 19. In Civilization III, there were 9, introduced in the second expansion, Conquests. And then in Civilization II, there was 21, 20 of which came from the very first expansion pack for Civilization II, which was entitled Conflicts in Civilization. So the fact that, for the most part, the number of scenarios that are going down, as far as the official releases go, does not surprise me at all. And that's because of the modding community and high-speed internet access, and more people spending more time online, and more people being online, and greater tool availability and tool knowledge and experience in order to create these scenarios.
People don't want to buy expansions on things like this so much anymore because we get so many scenarios from the modding community. It's just the same thing as some of the RPG type games. There's so much stuff you can get that people make. You don't need an official expansion for fancy things.
Exactly. I know there are people that are excited about these scenarios, and certainly 14 people in this poll said that they're fairly excited for them all. 3 of them say, I can't decide, and 17 say, I really couldn't care less about the scenarios, and although I haven't voted in the poll yet, if I were to vote, I'm afraid I'm going to have to go into the I really couldn't care less about the scenarios. I wouldn't phrase it as disparagingly as that. Of the poll options, that's true, and that's just simply because I am not interested in playing scenarios, but for those of you who are interested in playing scenarios, I think it's great that there are some that are being included.
I'm pretty much in the same boat. I'm not a scenario player. It just doesn't kind of hold my interest. I like to play the base game better, but actually these ones do look quite intriguing. The steampunk scenario and also the Fall of Rome looks really interesting to me. I can't wait to play it.
If there's a soundtrack for the Empire of the Smoky Skies scenario, I'll listen to that.
Yeah.
While I play the base game. I know it's probably not what the developers were going for, but...
I'm basically in the same boat where, you know, it doesn't really matter the Civ game. I don't run the scenarios a great deal, so it doesn't really matter to me a whole lot.
Yeah, I admit, even in the old game, I would try them at least once, but I didn't think I went back to a lot of them, because once you play it the first time, you know... there's achievements attached, probably. Some people go through them more than once.
Really, like a steampunk thing, that might be interesting.
Steampunk.
But
by CYZ, and it's to do with the question of, do we want to have an upgrade path for the scout unit? At the moment, you have scouts, you build them in the early game, you send them out there, but then sort of once the game progresses on to Medieval Renaissance, those units, they never upgrade to anything. They can get a couple of promotions and everything, but they just basically stay the same for the entire game. And this thread is questioning whether or not we should include some upgrades for the scouts. There's a few suggestions here. The first one is the Explorer, which was also a Civ 4 unit. And then it could be like a Commando or a Ranger. And the type of units that these would be will be guys that have sort of extra move points, ignore terrain cost. Some people even suggested ignore zone of control for later units and sort of like bonuses to vision and scouting. Now, for my own self, the problems that I have with this is that in a standard game, once you get to the point that you'd have these upgrades, the map's already pretty much scouted out anyway. Well, it is if you use your scouts properly. and these units, some of the abilities that they're suggesting that these units could have, I think they'll have the side effect is that they'll actually be used in other areas not scouting. For instance, like the, say, if you have a unit that has extra move points and ignores terrain, ignores zone of control, and that unit's going to come in really handy in a military attacking city.
Pillaging.
Yeah, pillaging. Remember in Civ 5, they have the mechanic where...
Good points. He's suggesting that. Just think about what that would happen. I'd have Sherman's marks coming from a couple of different directions with commandos.
And the other big thing that makes me think this is that in Civ 5, when a city is reduced to one hit point, it can be taken by any unit. You could get a 100 strength city being bombarded down to one hit point, and a one hit point scout can take that 100% of the time. With these units, these explorers units, will actually be really good at being city cappers, coming in from distance, ignoring all terrain, and taking the city. And that doesn't really fit with the theme that these units are supposed to be. So I see some problems there. There's some other good suggestions on this thing. There's a suggestion about a balloon unit. So it would be the balloon would be the first flying unit in the game. It's basically just a unit that would be stationed in a city, and then you'd send it on sort of recon runs. It can't actually move around the map. It just does runs from the city to highlight, to give you line of sight to certain places. That idea's got some that could be kind of cool, but...
Well, first off, to me, the
similar to the airships in Civ 4.
That's what I was going to say. Except it sounds like the balloon one, it's non-combat, though, because the airship in Civ 4 did have a combat capability.
Yeah, it was pretty meager, but it does. It's true, and it could make a difference, whereas this won't do anything. But in terms of its recon capabilities, it's basically the same thing. You get a nice chunk of area revealed.
Flying a hot air balloon for scouting just sounds...
Yeah. It won't be as cool with quick combat on. You just see some hexes revealed.
I think Civilization 5 does scouting better than Civilization 4. Kind of ties into partially what Danny was saying. First off, most of these suggestions have to do with it would be in the later game when the map is revealed, or at least should be revealed. And it is a reason why a lot of people decried the Explorer in Civilization 4, which the Scout would upgrade to, because by that point it was next to pointless. I'm probably being generous with that. Whereas in Civilization 5, the Scout obsoletes its scientific theory. There is no Explorer unit. But the Scout itself, from the outset, ignores terrain cost, which you can get to in Civilization 4 for certain types of terrain, or if you go really far down the line, then they absolutely ignore terrain cost, and actually the Explorer has that from the outset. But in Civilization 5, you've got a couple of promotion line options. You actually have the Scouting line, but there's also Sentry 2 for scouting in Civ 5, but I prefer Survivalism, because with that, Survivalism 1, one hit point healed per turn outside of friendly territory, and then if you can get to Survivalism 2, plus 50% defense, and then, crazy, I've never actually seen a Survivalism 3-1, but if you do get that far, then the unit will heal every turn, even if it performs an action. It probably won't survive long enough for that, but... The fact that the Scout in Civilization 5 ignores terrain cost from the outset, you have a survivalism option, I really don't see actually a need or even a desire to add to the existing Scout unit or to even attach scouting capabilities for units. Also, in part to the fact that what Danny was saying, that with regards to, you know, getting a city down to, you know, zero hit points, and then, you know, the one hit point Scout could come in, if you were to attach that to an actual combat unit, that just makes that capability even more redonkulous. Now, for Civilization 4, of course, I already talked about the GS you could upgrade to an Explorer, and that comes at Compass. Scout in Civilization 4 gives you better results from tribal villages, can only defend, it's got 100% versus animals, which you don't have barbarian animals in Civilization 5. But the promotion line in Civilization 4 for scouts is more interesting, but I think it works well in Civilization 4. I mean, who does not love a super medic scout? So, you know, you go down combat, and then you can go down the medic line. Or my general, actually, preference for an initial scout early on is actually the woodsman, because then you can get moved faster in jungles and forests between woodsman 1 and then woodsman 2, plus there's greater defense in there. Or you could also go the guerrilla path, which is for faster movement and better defense in hills. I don't see the desire to change for Civilization 5, or even putting it into a Civilization 6, unless there are sufficient changes in game mechanics that then make us kind of take a step back and go, wait a minute, why would we want to move that from Civ 5 to Civ 6 when this is different, or this is removed, or whatever the case happens to be? I think the upgrade path for scouting is fine, for both games overall.
Yeah, I don't see any problem with scouting either game, honestly.
If there was usually a lot of the map still to be discovered at the time when people are suggesting that this unit came to be, then yeah, it could make sense. But right now, it's just going to be an explorer that doesn't really act like an explorer. The possible balance changes that are going to come in with Gods and Kings. Like, we know that there are certain things in Civ 5 vanilla that make the game a little bit imbalanced, like research agreements and great scientist bulb in particular. Now, we know that the developers gave some thought to the research agreements, that now there's going to need to be good friends, quote, to sign research agreements. Now, we don't know, I don't think we know for sure whether or not that means just friendly status or declaration of friendship. But that does show that they're looking to limit research agreements. Now, what about great scientist bulbing? That's another thing that I think needs to be addressed. And we don't know if it will or not.
It's very interesting. I like research agreements more than tech traits. I've always said that. I still think that research agreements are too strong relative to other sources of outputs, but it's a step in the right direction. But I don't know if I like the going back to the concept of if you spawn near somebody, you can get huge tech advantages versus somebody who does in the early game because it's only one person gets access to the research agreement. And I don't know what the right answer is here, but if you require friendly status, then, you know, there's a lot of luck that starts coming into gameplay. Where you wind up with people willing to work with you or people who aren't. And if the other people are willing to work with each other, you kind of skirt it. Even if you don't necessarily do anything wrong. Like, you can play as well as you possibly can and just have no chance because the research agreements are so one-sided. And so unless they just weaken their overall effect, which I would not mind one bit, then I wouldn't have as much problem with it. And I would also like to see the great scientist effect. Weekend. Because like you say, man, that's just crazy. You stock up a couple of great scientists, you can jump an arrow out of two arrows very quickly and get some kind of ridiculous military advantages on people that probably won't be recovered.
That's right. You get in stealth bombers and, you know, the tie into 1200s is possible on standard maps, and this is just due to the really overpowered nature of research agreements and great scientists. Like, even my own game now, I've started to implement house rules where for the first 150 turns, I just force myself, I have to settle every great person that I pop. Just because saving up great scientists to just really chew through the tech tree at the end of the game it makes the game really easy.
If you reduce their value back like they were in Civ 4, where they had a fixed beaker value that they would give, basically, and for later technologies, they would not discover technology in one hit.
That's right, yeah. So, well, something like that is definitely the way to go. You work it off the base science rate, so like the higher your base rate, the better research agreement or bulb you'll get. But I definitely think that one great scientist should not be able to discover stealth in one hit. They're just way too powerful. But if you can make it a partial or amount of beakers, some people thought even maybe perhaps like great scientist bulb could just function like a research agreement. We just don't want people getting like 13, 14 free techs in a row at the end of the game, because it just leaves it open to so much manipulation to get really deep in the tech tree, get really powerful units, and then just completely own the map.
I think part of that, you know, the random element that Phil was getting to, where in terms of, we're getting to the diplomatic modifiers here. We know that we are going to be losing the negative diplomatic modifier. Oh, you're trying to win the game like us, which is great. But then at the same time, that friend benefit, it also depends, you know, how heavily weighted that's going to be. Things that are more in your control as compared to not in your control. Like, it could just be that, well, they've decided that your borders are close, and therefore you now have a negative modifier against them. And it could be, okay, I want to settle towards you, but I don't want to settle too close to you, because then we have that negative modifier. But then often you find that the AI just turns around and does that. They settle towards you, they're right up against your borders, and then they're mad at you because you're, to use Civ 4's expression, your borders, close borders, spark tension.
Yeah.
Be mitigated if they prioritize those research agreements at the value they are. In other words, if they will literally be much less likely to go after you because of your research agreement and because of your declaration of friendship, and they'll really hang on to that friendship because it's so valuable for research, then this won't be as much of a problem, but you'll have very, very block-like games where you turn into threat back in combat. Basically, at least until the very late game, which, you know, that might not be horrible, but it's certainly divergent from what we've seen in the past. And honestly, I don't know, I think that might be interesting. I don't know if I want every game to go that way. If you have research agreements like they are theoretically going to be, it might turn into that, where you always have two or three civs doing research agreements in groups constantly.
The groups may be dictated by the religion mechanic, you know, that's kind of gives you a lot of ability to sort of perhaps get into stable friendships in the early game, and also later in the game there's going to be whether or not you are running autocracy, order, or freedom. So yeah, you could sort of manipulate it in the beginning of the game where you adopt the same religion as the civ next to you, and then certain civs will have certain flavors, like Montezuma might always go for autocracy, and you can sort of, you might be able to manipulate the diplo situation to get really strong, long-lasting friendships. And if research agreements are quite scarce, then that could be quite valuable.
I just don't want to see Civ 4's strength of religion come back, because yeah, that's one of the things about Civ 5 I liked over Civ 4, is that, as sad as it is to say, Diplo is a bit more dynamic in this regard, because you couldn't really iron out the Diplo situation almost entirely by simply choosing religion. I mean, yeah, there's plenty of conflict diplomacy in both games to go around, granted, but it was such a dominating factor in Civ 4 that it got to the point where you could get away with murder, and as long as you're running some guy's religion, then he'll probably go after you anyway. And in some ridiculous cases, you can declare war on a friend like 4 times, and they're still pleased with you and won't declare war. It's like, well...
In Civ 5, if you get into a triangle, or even multiple triangles with a declaration of friendship with one civ who has a declaration of friendship with another civ who you also do, and then having those stack and stagger and continually renew, you know, you really do build up a lot of positive modifiers, and you'd be surprised at what you can get away with in Civ 5 and still keep those friends, so long as you are in one of those triangles. That's the key thing. People have a random declaration of friendship here and a random declaration of friendship there. What you really want to be is in one of those triangles, so you get the reinforcing modifiers over and over.
Makes sense, but you got to work your way into that. It's not a guarantee just by picking something right away.
No, yeah, we shouldn't have it just like, I want to be friends with this guy forever, I'll just adopt his religion. I don't think anyone wants that. And it won't be even either, because we know that religion, as to diplomacy, yeah, is going to become less and less important during the game.
It's true.
But we just don't know how big these effects are going to have on diplomacy yet. We just have to wait and see. I hope they work it out, because diplomacy is one of the weaker parts of the game. It needs to be tweaked.
It's hard with the AI, though. It's really, really hard.
Yeah.
I don't want to make excuses for them. You know how I feel about some things in the game, but it's really difficult to get an AI to think at the high strategic level when it comes to planning around other people's actions.
It's hard to get the AI to think like a human player, and that even if you're at +9 or +10 friendly with them, to be like, yeah, well, you're in my way for winning. Backstab.
Yeah. Easier in a straight war game, but in the games like this, it's a little more difficult, because you have other things, and ultimately everyone's going to have to kill everyone.
Would you prefer it in Civ 5 if there was +10, +5, you know, values, or would you prefer it being more opaque the way it is now?
Yeah, knowing why. We like you because we like you in religion school, or we like you because you agree with our policies, we have the same one.
See some tie in between your actions and their responses to it. That way you know that some choices you made had an impact on the game one way or another, because in a lot of cases, you if it's too opaque, you start running into that problem, where you're like, okay, well, they pissed at me just because they're close, or they pissed at me because of something I did, or, you know, whatever. And some of the things that they get pissed at that they don't necessarily show, you probably hear, or, you know, you probably have leaders in your ear in real life that you did those things, such as the warmongering menace to the world and how that builds up. You'd probably hear something right away if a country declared war and went to and started capturing cities belonging to another country, Russia or something. Then, you find someone in your ear, a little bit at least. They'd probably not be waiting and just typing in mechanic there. So, I don't know. If you make it totally in the open, you need to deploy to be pretty good then. But I don't see anything necessarily wrong with going that route. And there's no never done it. I'd be interested to see how community responds if they do make it totally, you know, totally clear what all the modifiers. I can't think of a SIV that did that ever.
In SIV 5, if you haven't like looked under the hood or been on the forums where people talk about this, there is quite a lot of pretty esoteric stuff in diplomacy. You know, like about the penalty you get when you actually wipe a SIV out. The common tactic is now to leave a SIV with one small city alive. Now, this is not explained to you in the game, and that has a really big effect on the diplomatic stance of the other SIVs.
Yeah, and we covered that quite a few episodes ago. And I expressed my displeasure with mechanics like that in particular, because there's no logical reason that they would get really mad at you for taking that last city versus the other 15 cities. It should be bad, I mean, certainly, you're still committing genocide, but it should be no worse than, like, the capital you took, or those two cities you raised, or whatever else. And the fact that you have no way of knowing, yeah, that's an example of, you know, something where I feel like they dropped the ball. That they really should make the game mechanics clear to us. Especially when it's that esoteric. And Civ 4 had its quirks like that too. I mean, you give a rookie the game, and they open up the trade screen and try to get someone to declare their war on someone else. And it says, we have enough line on our hands right now. They're like, well, what does that mean? Well, like, veterans know that means that AI is plotting war, or it's at war. Or if it's not at war with anyone that they can see, then it's plotting war. And if you look at their diplomatist positions, you can even figure out who they're plotting against. So you have the game very inaccessible to people just trying to pick it up, and really for no good reason, because ultimately an experienced player is going to be able to determine exactly who that AI is attacking and determine that they're attacking. But somebody who just picked the game up, they won't. So they're the big disadvantage, and again, unless they read the forums or go under the hood.
It was even worse at the beginning on release of Civ 5. Remember, we didn't even get any little green text or red text about it, and you were supposed to just sort of work it out by body language or something about what the leader thought about you. They're making steps in that direction. It's just about getting that balance between having the mechanics there so that you can, you know, yeah, you can see the result of your actions, but not having it so that you can totally manipulate it the way that you can in Civ 4 sometimes.
Do you want to sign a pact of secrecy with me against Dan?
Oh,
it does, but let's sign that pact.
We've signed it.
Yeah, which you've said out loud. A couple of points on this extended discussion. I would actually like to see a return to, with the diplomatic modifiers, whether it's good or bad, actually seeing the numbers or some kind of equivalent so that I know that this is weighed more heavily than something else and something that gives me some kind of relative scale understanding. So that way, if kind of also getting under the hood. So you can think about it if you want, and if you really don't care about it, then I think just even having a number beside whether it's a good or a bad value, eventually, if you're not interested in it, I think you'll see it, but it won't register. It's kind of like hearing something but not listening to something. It really wouldn't be obstructive for someone who didn't want to know that kind of more detailed information to distract them. And on the research agreement part, I would just like it to see that if you enter into a research agreement, that yes, of course, there is a payoff at the end of however long that research agreement is going to last, 20 turns, 25 turns, whatever it happens to be, especially with how the AI can tend to behave, I just don't want it to be, especially where you have that upfront gold investment, which I think is good, I just don't want a situation where if we're 19, if I'm 19 turns into the 20 research agreement, and then that AI turns around and declares on me that I get absolutely nothing other than a loss on my freaking, you know, my balance sheet, as it were, for my Civ, I get nothing for that investment. Like, have it up to, you know, the end, that you have some kind of incremental. It could even just be if it's at, like, 10, 15% of what it is that you would get at the end anyway, but just something, so that it's not completely like, well, the AI flaked out on me, and now I'm screwed. Or even at the same time, you could actually turn around and do... Actually, I don't know why you would do that to the AI, but I suppose you could turn around and do that to the AI if you realize, you know what, they're going to benefit more from this this research agreement than I am. I'm going to cancel it before they manage to get anything from it.
You get such a massive return, a beaker to gold return on research agreements anyway. I think there needs to be some risk involved, or else, I don't know. The fact that you lose one here and there to declarations of war, does it really stop you signing them?
I accept that there should be risk, but especially for some of the newer players or people getting into it, I think that would be a real turnoff to realize that you got absolutely nothing. You should get some kind of return.
Probably be the best thing to just get the gold back, because you get so many beakers back normally, depending on what you get from the research agreement.
I wouldn't even necessarily say that you maybe get all of the gold back, but...
Let's say, okay, what is it, 25 turns? Let's say you spent 250 gold to get it, so for every turn left, you get 10 gold. So there's 10 turns left, you get 100 gold back.
I would be happy with getting that something back. I mean, it makes sense that you don't actually, okay, get maybe incremental research until the research agreement is done, but if you don't get that far, then given that we have the upfront gold cost,
you've already invested that much money into it, you can't get it back, so to speak.
Yeah.
You do realize we're talking about making research agreements even stronger here, right?
Well, if you weakened the beakers thing when you added the gold back thing, maybe.
Just get part of the gold back. Forget about even any incremental beakers. You just get part of the gold back, however far you are into the research agreement.
I mean, I wasn't saying you got any beakers back. If you had the research agreement running, then there was a declaration of war. It's like they confiscated all that stuff you jointly invested in. So you don't get what you'd invested up to that point back, you just get whatever the remainder was, or something.
Yes. Well, I would be okay with that. I mean, I wouldn't be happy that the research agreement was canceled and I've already been declared on, but at least I wouldn't feel like, okay, no compensation for that. Practical compensation. It's kind of like the return on an investment on a savings account. It's crap, but it is there, theoretically.
The research agreements are already so strong. Getting something back if they go bad. I mean, what does the AI get back? Nothing.
You know, since we're paying the same amount for the research agreement when we signed it, they get the exact same gold amount value back the human does. Now, it's true that the AI likes to hoard its gold, so I know that there's the... or hopefully they're working on that, too, but that's...
Yeah, it likes its piles of shiny.
Steal gold! Troll!
Oh, that'd be great in espionage. Steal AI's gold!
It's pretty weak in Civ 4, but it's not so weak.
No.
They have that much gold on them.
For episode 122 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian Team, Q&L, and Thorburn.
Now, there's a legitimate complaint, and I think it would be good for us to weigh in on it, about using the mods changes instead of doing it on their own. You know, at some point you're talking about people making serious developmental efforts into the game that aren't part of Firaxis staff and are not receiving anything for that. And you do start to run into issues there. You know, why is their work worth less than those of the people who put in the original features that were inferior, for example? And just how much of the game is being fan-made, and then what are the fans paying for? If they're making so much of the game on their own, where do you draw the line there? And certainly that is an issue. I still think Firaxis should borrow from the mod community if it makes the game better. But there is there's some moral qualms there, and I can understand them, although I do not do any mod work on my own.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that too. I understand what you're saying. But again, like I said, I mean, I love the City of State Diplomacy mod. I very rarely play without that mod now anymore, which means I don't get achievements or anything, but still.
That can be a really a fugly landscape, to put it in one way. In one sense, I think the modders recognize that if they're making this stuff available for anybody in the community, then Phyrexians, too, are part of the community. I mean, a lot of the people, they're playing games, they probably like games, they should like games, I'm sure they do like games, and so they're trying them themselves, and then if it's, okay, let's include that. I think that if they're going to be using somebody's work in the mod community, if they made it available for, you know, public consumption and public use, so long as there is a credit in the credits of the game, maybe it's just acknowledged on a website or something to say that this was taken from. You may also want to get into consideration whether or not Firaxis or 2K should have to write or get written permission, an email or something from someone. I think a nice nod to the community would be just to acknowledge, hey, that this is where this came from, because modders were putting that out there for free. Hey, this was taken directly from Joe753's awesome City State mod, and I just completely made that up. Such a mod or such a user.
Recorded for episode 124 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian team, Cartamandua, and Majin.
Can play Civ 5 with no victory conditions on. I actually noticed this because I was changing some configuration settings, and all of a sudden, the setting that I changed in terms of the setup got rid of all the victory conditions. They were all unchecked. Now, I caught this, and apparently if you indeed check no victory conditions, then the game really does never end. I mean, it's
seriously?
Yep.
It just keeps going and going and going.
This would be a really funny trick to play on someone.
Really, you can't win. Oh, seriously.
Someone reported that they got to 2071 AD or CE, whichever you prefer. They were the only civilization left, and the game did not end.
Oh, wow.
It could be fun if you want to do the forever game where you're just playing around and, you know, after you win, you just keep building stuff to see what, you know, you can get. But given that you have no win conditions available, you'll never get a Hoff score out of it. So you can't really compare it.
They run out of things to build. Every city would have every building option they had available.
Yeah. And then it'd get really boring.
Yeah.
You'd just be hitting intern infinitely.
Yeah.
Try to get a unit on every tile, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, and because it'll never end, you can't ever see the replay.
Oh, well, hey, there's an achievement that wants you to have a standing army of 100 units. There's a good way to do it.
True, because whoever needs 100 units?
I heard it's all possible on huge maps, but I can't picture those being very playable right now.
Recorded for episode 134 with Dan Q, Makalua, the Mian team, MSLS, and Locutus.
How to keep Civ 4/Polycast interesting. No. It just says, how do you keep Civ 4 interesting? Nothing about Polycast. So we'll have to look to tips elsewhere. This thread is started by Salty Mud. And he says that Civilization 4 is one of those rare games where they seem to get better with age, not worse. Okay. The more you play, the more you learn, the more you want to play. But even so, it's nice to change things up a little from time to time and to keep you on your toes and stop the game from getting a bit samey. Nice. I like making up words, too. So what is it you would like to do to keep the game fresh and interesting? And he has a poll, which I am almost certain is the reason Dan chose this topic.
Aww,
I just read off the poll. If I didn't read off the poll, I'm sure Dan would do so. So there's with 22 votes, I play with different civs as often as I can, and I play in different style worlds, 40.74% of the votes. Other options are I play different difficulties, I play different game speeds, I play with the strategy in mind from the beginning, I play to my civ strengths, I don't play to my civ strengths for extra challenge. That's also known as cherry tapping. I don't know why this guy didn't include the word cherry tapping in the poll. That's a negative with me right away. You need to use the phrase cherry tapping as often as possible. And also, I play by certain house rules. I play historically or other. Please explain. And other got a lot of votes at second at 21, and that's probably because this doesn't have a multiplayer option.
Or a modal university, yeah, or the Civ Fanatics challenges. And so I play with different civs as often as I can. Yeah. It's called going commando, so...
That's Dan true too. So that's two strikes right against this poll. Well, that's what playing with a random civ and leader means. You're going commando, and that's not to be confused with any knife lunges in Call of Duty, because commando is actually a little bit more difficult.
Are you getting on average
in Civilization? Well, yeah, but that's different from Call of Duty in that it never depends on anything. It's the best weapon in the game as long as you're close to someone.
That's
so
right.
It is a little different.
It's commando.
No. You know, I think some of our listening audience isn't quite understanding what you're saying when you say commando, so let me help you out. It's called going commando.
Yes.
You have to get the affectation right or people don't understand. Okay, I just thought I'd clarify for everyone.
The other commando is when you spawn as Inca right next to another AI. That's going, commando.
So yeah, you have a lot of options to keep a game interesting. And certainly modding. This is something I've always been interested in, picking up some of the mods. But you know, I do play other games in Civ 4, which is sort of blasphemy, but sort of not. Certainly you can try Hall of Fame out, although that's technically a mod too. That's Buffy. And so you have a lot of options if you want to keep Civ 4 interesting. And I don't think a single person could exhaust all of them if they enjoy just playing the game. You know, eventually you run out of time.
Yeah, I mean, think of all the years you've probably tried right now to win at Civilization IV. Try to play to lose. There's another how many years?
There's actually forum challenges for that, Dan. You're supposed to take a vassal and then force the vassal to win the game.
That's cool.
It's actually not that hard. You just screw over everyone else until he eventually launches a ship. You can even get them the tax. But yeah, that's definitely playing to lose.
You shuffle lots of money at them.
Yeah. That too, if you wish. Usually their bonuses are enough, though. They have more money than they spend anyway, because they're stupid. Kind of like Civ 5 AI. Let's just hold on to money and do nothing with it. It's a brilliant, very brilliant move.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
My wife said to me by gospel, please fix that garage door. Yes, tomorrow, I say, a week later. That's a really weak week. Can you please fix that garage door? I say, I thought I fixed it already. No, you won the wars against the Greeks and Russians, but you didn't even think about the door, did you? Sorry, I forgot. I'll fix it tomorrow. Next day, her dad and my so-called brother-in-law, that's kind of deep, And they fix the garage door in 2 minutes. They go crazy, sort out the gutters, not only that, whippersnapper the whole fence. Cost him a 6-pack, but he could play a few more turns. He counts that as a win! And yeah, that sounds like a big win to me. Might be in the doghouse a little bit there, but that'll pass, and there you go.
Yeah, it's kind of the equivalent of, but your father and brother-in-law do it so much better than I do.
Exactly.
They're efficient, they're inexpensive.
Probably said something like, have you seen me trying to change the toilet roll? Do you really want me to fix the garage door? No, you don't.
Like I said, that showing competence in anything that's a lot of work, that's probably not a good idea. I would take advantage of it.
No, of course not. Like when she says, no, you won the war against the Greeks and the Russians, but you didn't even think about the door. I'm worrying about the forest, you can worry about the trees.
Just not racist.
Honey, I'm taking the long-term view.
Exactly.
That is not how you complete your honey-do list.
Wait, is the objective to actually complete that list, though? I thought...
Well, someone would like you to. So you've been listening to Polycast episode 146. I'm Makalua, and with us today was, of course, Dan Quick.
That's an hour of your life you can't get back.
Me and team.
My do list has a list of other people's civilizations on it.
And Danny.
Still waiting for 10 answers to 10 questions for Axis.
Is that any better?
Yes, that's better. And your temporary absence gave me the opportunity to sing. But,
God.
Continue.
I cry. What was I saying? Oh, yes.
Mackie's being really quiet because she's really angry if she's going to rant, right? We're wrong, right, Mackie?
No.
Oh, that's boring.
Sorry.
Rant would be really amusing. I would love to see that. You need to rant.
Why, you know you scout. That would be a rant.
I think that takes us to the end. Closing time indeed, and I will not sing Semisonic here, although I can.
Thank you.
Uh, you're closing, Maggie.
Oh, right. I'm so used to not having to do the closing. I don't know what I'm doing.
Record date May 5th, 2012. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.